The Colin McEnroe Show will be carrying a live feed from today's Trump rally, but as part of a new initiative, we'll offer simultaneous interpretation.
The election is absolutely being rigged by the dishonest media, pushing false allegations and outright lies in an effort to elect Hillary Clinton president.
I'm losing. Boy, am I losing. I will probably lose by 35 million votes. That's the population of Canada. I'm going to lose by Canada.
We should take a drug test before the debate. I don't know what's going on with her, but in the last debate, she was all pumped up at the beginning.
I looked at her face and thought, was I ever that happy, even as a child? When the debate was over, I locked myself in a dark room with my childhood sled and my stuffed animals, but I could tell even Mr. Pip the Bunny and Brownie Hedgehog didn't want to play with me.
Hillary Clinton meets in secret with international banks to plot the destruction of U.S. sovereignty in order to enrich these global financial powers, her special interest friends, and her donors.
I think one of the lunatics from Breitbart loaded something anti-Semitic into my teleprompter.
Everything that has transpired has done so according to my design. Your friends up there on the sanctuary moon are walking into a trap, as is your rebel fleet. An entire legion of my best troops awaits them.
Is that from Star Wars? I think it might be. Something is wrong with the teleprompter.
In conclusion, I would like to say that today I received the endorsements of General Douglas MacArthur and Professor Ludwig von Drake, who happens to be the smartest duck in the world.
The teleprompter totally broke. Now I am just making things up. Maybe we should switch over to a radio show of some kind. And now he was groped by Dr. No, Colin McEnroe.
I was groped by Dr. No, and he used that icky black hand of his. And I kept saying, no means no, and he kept saying, that's my name, and it was terrible. All right, we are going to talk about the very dark and strange turns that the Donald Trump campaign has taken, which I think was also our topic last Monday. I'm not 100% sure, but I think it was our topic last Monday. But these are a whole new group of dark and strange turns. It used to be that people would say that if Donald Trump won, they would move to Canada. Now, I think they should say if he loses, they should move to Canada, because clearly he's setting the stage for some kind of unrest in the event of his defeat, his almost inevitable, I would guess, defeat. Here to talk to us, I should say, in the final segment of today's show, David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR News, is going to join us because I think the media faces a unique task. And a daunting task, and I'm sure we'll be alluding to that over the course of the conversation we're about to have now. But it's the task of how do you cover an election where one of the candidates is suggesting that you, the media, are part of some global conspiracy against him? How do you reality test anything? But that's also going to run through these first couple of segments here. We're very lucky to have with us from The Washington Post, Philip Rucker, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, and Sarah Kendzior joining us by phone, writer, researcher, and critic, a commentator on the political scene for many publications. So, Phil Rucker, I'm going to have you get us started. I sort of tried to sum up the strange turn that Donald Trump's rhetoric has taken over the last, well, I'll say really since the second debate. He's gone off in a whole new direction. I don't know if I left anything out, but basically, what message is he sending over and over?
Well, you summed it up pretty well. It's a pretty remarkable turn, actually. Normally, losing candidates try to expand their political reach to bring in new voters, to appeal to new supporters. And Trump is doing the opposite. He's turning inward, and his whole message is based on conspiracies and sort of dark fears and grievances and vitriol. And, you know, there's a danger to that in that the election itself, many of his supporters now believe, is going to be stolen from him. And so that leaves open the possibility that maybe he won't accept the loss if he loses, that his supporters could create some unrest across the country in that event. So it's something that's alarming Clinton advisors and I think a lot of other people in the country right now.
Sarah, you wrote that, I mean, this has been going on for a while in a way. I think you found as far back as August 1st, Donald Trump was starting to use terms like rigged election in ways that suggested that maybe some of the results would not be trustworthy. So what's different now?
Not much is different now. I mean, you nailed it. It's been going on for a while. on August 1st, I think, was the first time that Trump said the election was going to be rigged. Around that point, Roger Stone said that there was going to be a bloodbath if Trump loses the election, which, of course, could only happen if it was rigged. Trump, as far back as 2014, was calling for riots as a sort of, you know, cleansing force to America that would bring back America to what it was. This was said on a Fox News interview. And also his surrogates during the primary season when he was down a bit, and there were, you know, there was unrest and protest at the Trump rallies, called for, you know, riots then. And Trump offered to pay the legal fees of, you know, protesters who engaged in violence. And so this call for, you know, riots, bloodshed, violence, you know, all backed by white supremacists is not new at all. I think it's just people are paying more attention to it.
And Phil, one of the groups of people paying attention to it are not just the Clinton campaign leadership, but Republican leadership. Paul Ryan has had to say something about it. And even Mike Pence, his running mate, without repudiating specifically Donald Trump, has talked about the American tradition of a peaceful transition of power. It doesn't seem, though, as though that's going to reach Donald Trump. But I guess one of the questions everybody has is, to what degree could there be some kind of bipartisan consensus at the time of the election that this isn't going to be the way things are done? And I guess whether or not the people who have been reached by this rhetoric would listen to anybody but Trump.
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. I mean, there is such a cult of personality around Trump, such a force, a real strength in his movement, and it really is a movement. These people listen to Trump. They believe what he says. And the things that Trump is saying now are not rooted in fact. I mean, these are dark conspiracies from people like Roger Stone and Alex Jones of the InfoWars website and Breitbart website. I mean, he's sort of basing his campaign now on this dark world that used to be the fringe of the Republican Party. He's bringing it mainstream. And, you know, 35 to 42% of America believes in it right now. And so they believe what he says. And it's really incumbent now on Trump to be clear about what direction he's giving to his followers.
Phil, I think in some ways there's a kind of – I mean, there are so many different iterations of this Trump campaign. But we're certainly in a third one that I can see. You know, for a long time you had Trump kind of following his own script, speaking in a very impromptu way, saying a lot of reckless things and contradictory things and things that he would subsequently deny 5 minutes later that he said. We know that version of Donald Trump. And then there was this sort of Kellyanne Conway version of the campaign preceded by several other people trying to exercise, you know, Paul Manafort, people like that, trying to exercise some control over him, maybe to get him to stay on script and stay on message and say kind of more conventional Republican conservative things without completely sacrificing the appeal to his original base. But it feels like there's a third thing here where a lot of the things that he's saying now, even things about like international banking conspiracies colluding with the press and Hillary Clinton, they're being read from a teleprompter, and they don't sound like the kinds of things Kellyanne Conway would tell him to say. So it does seem, Phil, as though the Breitbart side of his campaign, the Steve Bannon side of his campaign, is actually writing language for him to read off a prompter.
That's exactly right. And the speech you're referring to was the one he gave last Thursday, I believe, in West Palm Beach, Florida. He talked about a global conspiracy, the media, the Clinton campaign, the big banks, corporations all around the world, foreign governments, all colluding in very dark ways to undermine his campaign. And, you know, it came straight from Steve Bannon, who was the head executive at Breitbart and is now the chief executive of the Trump campaign. Mr. Bannon travels with Mr. Trump on the plane almost every day to these campaign events and is really having an outsized role in shaping his message. And another person on that team is Stephen Miller. He's the head policy director for the campaign, but also one of the main speechwriters. And he comes from this world of the Republican Party against sort of the globalists as they see it. He was a former aide to Senator Jeff Sessions. And Miller and Bannon together are really helping shape and drive the message of the Trump campaign in the home stretch here.
So one of the questions that I think a lot of people have, Sarah, is sort of who hears that dog whistle? And it's not even a dog whistle in some cases. It's not just audible to a small group of people. It's audible to everybody. Who hears that message and what do they do about it? I sort of completely missed this story, but there was this group of so-called Kansas Crusaders last week. Tell us about them.
Oh, the three men in Kansas who were arrested? Yeah, I mean, this is definitely not a dog whistle. This is a Pied Piper, and, you know, there are millions of Americans who are following along. And the three men in Kansas are of a, you know, white supremacist militia group called the Crusaders, and they had planned to blow up an apartment complex that housed Somali immigrants in Kansas, and they had planned this for the day after the election. And I think, you know, what's been happening is a lot of these plans have been in the works for a long time, and this actually isn't hard to discover. I mean, the Trump fans are fairly blatant about it. When I've interviewed them, they've told me about it. They post about it on their websites. But I think it was always held back because they thought, you know, there might be this chance that Trump would win. And, of course, if Trump won, you know, you'd find the same results. They would just carry on these same sort of plots with impunity. Now they're carrying them on in a state of, you know, rage and vengeance. And, you know, I would not be surprised if we see, you know, actual attacks that are able to be carried through following Election Day or even on Election Day, given Trump's rhetoric about, you know, voter rigging and the need for, you know, people to be watched, which is basically a call for voter intimidation.
And Phil, I mean, we've also seen, and who knows what this actually was, I'm a little bit suspicious of it, but we've seen arson at a North Carolina Republican headquarters. There's some way in which this campaign is veering away from just talk and a little bit more towards action, of the kind of action we would hope not to see in a campaign. Are you noticing that?
Certainly. And, you know, one of the things that Donald Trump says almost every time he campaigns in Pennsylvania, for example, is he tells his supporters, you need to be on the lookout for voter fraud. I want you to go into the, quote, certain places. And by that, he means the inner cities, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh. Go to those polling places and monitor them yourselves. Look out for people who might be trying to cheat. This is dangerous. We don't hear this normally from campaigns. Certainly, both parties historically have had teams of lawyers at polling places on Election Day trying to make sure there's no problem. But to incite thousands of supporters to go themselves into cities and try to intimidate voters or you know, quote unquote, stand guard, is creating the potential for some unrest in these areas.
One of the changes, Sarah, I think also is the way people get information these days. So, you know, I mean, I'm 62 years old. I've been, you know, reading and consuming and working for legacy media my entire adult life. And I have kind of a sense of sort of what kind of vetting process there is for a Washington Post story and, you know, what I can assume is the background and the case for a Slate.com story or something I see on CNN. But what's happening now, it seems as though, is people are getting in their feeds on either Facebook or Twitter, stuff, you know, from Alex Jones, stuff from some of these, from Breitbart. And it may be the case that everybody sort of, or some people anyway, are treating that information as though it exists on an even plane with other kinds of information.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I think people are in a bubble that, you know, consists of friends and other people they trust. I think there's enormous suspicion of the media, and I actually wouldn't limit that, you know, to the Trump camp. I think that that's true of Americans in general. And honestly, part of the problem of that and part of the reason that's true is because so much of the mainstream media has been complicit in elevating Trump and in making his extremist sentiment part of normal rhetoric. And so there often isn't a very fine line between something you would hear on Alex Jones or Breitbart, you know, especially since Breitbart is now literally part of the Trump campaign, and something you would see coming out of the mouth of a CNN surrogate. And so people, I think, you know, don't know who to trust, and they're seeing a lot of these, you know, fringe messages pulled to the center, and, you know, that has consequences. And unfortunately, I think the consequences of that are going to be violent.
All right, we're going to grab a quick break. We're going to come back with more of Phil and Sarah right after the proverbial this. I Welcome back to our Monday Scramble. It increasingly, with each passing week, feels like we should be scrambling for cover. Philip Rucker is joining us from the Washington Post, national political correspondent for the Washington Post. Sarah Kendzior, writer, researcher, critic. Her commentary on the political scene appears in many publications. Phil, one of the pieces that you've put up over the last 24, 48 hours includes a quote from Newt Gingrich, who is something of a surrogate anyway for Donald Trump, although with each new appearance, Newt seems to be separating himself a little bit. But he says they instead of we a lot of times, I notice. And one of the things he says in your piece is that this is, you know, this is about, among other things, breaking the media or breaking the media elite. What do you think he means when he says break the media?
Well, there's a perception not only in a Trump campaign, but in sort of the grassroots base of the Republican Party, the conservative grassroots, that the media is biased, that reporters don't really understand their movement, don't understand their lifestyles, feel like their selection of stories, the way they play stories, and the way they report stories and write stories and talk about them on the radio and on television is biased in favor of elitist, quote-unquote elitist candidates like Hillary Clinton. And that's been become a core message from Donald Trump's campaign. When I go to his rallies, I was at one last week in Florida, there's tremendous vitriol and animus for reporters. We get booed. We get hissed at. There was a rally last week in Cincinnati where a Trump supporter left a poster with a swastika sign on it on the workstations where the reporters were going to be working. So there's a real sense of us versus them in the Trump movement, us versus them being, you know, we're against the media, against the establishment, against the elites of the country and of the world. And that's a powerful message in Trump's mind, and it's why he's building on it every day.
So, Sarah, this new strategy that's evolved most notably or has taken such an extreme turn over the last 7 days seems to have followed, obviously, the really bad weekend, the previous weekend, where the Billy Bush bus tape surfaced, followed by kind of a creepy debate in which he was not all that effective. And he did talk at that time about locking up his opponent. But it seems as though his strategy is one of the ways that you deal with The Washington Post and The New York Times and CBS and NBC and anybody else who's reporting the details of your activities is to lump everything into a vast, huge cauldron of stuff that's untrue. So basically what he's saying is, rather than debate the specifics of any particular charge by some woman who says she was groped or otherwise assaulted by him, he points to that cauldron, right? He says, everything in there is untrue. They're out to get me. And it kind of relieves him of the responsibility of addressing any specific fact.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, that's been true throughout the campaign. And it's basically, you know, easy to, you know, figure out what Trump's take on a particular outlet or the media in general is going to be. And that's whether or not they're favorable to him, because he actually does distinguish. I mean, just, I don't know if you saw it, but about an hour ago, he tweeted something positive about CNN because CNN had him up in a poll. And that was after, you know, trashing CNN relentlessly for weeks, despite the fact that CNN has his former campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski, on staff. So, you know, Trump's temper flares along with, you know, what kind of statistics he sees, what kind of polls he sees, what kind of coverage he gets. You know, you saw the same sort of temperament after the Democratic convention, you know, when he absolutely melted down after the polls rose. That was the week that he feuded with the Han family and with a baby and called for Hillary to be assassinated and for Russia to hack emails and, you know, all sorts of things. So basically, the minute his, you know, very thin skin is injured, he lashes out. And you're correct that he does, you know, lash out en masse. I think he taps into a perception of the media that already existed, you know, a distrust that's been stoked by Breitbart and by all these other, you know, fringe websites for a very long time that's now been, you know, pushed into, you know, our discourse as a mainstream perspective.
You know, Phil, one of the points that you make in your article, and you made it right at the top of this interview, too, but I want to come back to it now, is obviously the numbers suggested that Trump's biggest job, even going into last weekend, was to somehow or other expand his voter base, to somehow or other locate people within the contingent of undecided voters or voters who at least have not specifically assigned their vote to either him or to Hillary Clinton, just to get more of them. He needed more of them. You always need more of them in an election, but you especially need more more of them when you're behind. And he was already behind going into last weekend. And I don't know, maybe you can say a little bit more about this, but you're kind of suggesting as though you're suggesting that he doesn't really seem to be pursuing that strategy. He's not really doing the things that you would do if you wanted more people to flock to your standard.
That's right. I mean, presidential campaigns historically have been about addition and not subtraction. You want to appeal to as many people as you can. We live in a big, beautiful, diverse country, and there are a lot of different viewpoints to incorporate. And the person who gets elected president is usually that person who can appeal to and win over the largest group of Americans. And what Trump is doing instead is trying to turn inward to his base. And he's calculating that there's going to be what he calls a silent majority, that there are a lot of aggrieved working class white people who affiliate with Donald Trump, who like what he has to say, who are not showing up in the polls that we're looking at, who have not voted historically, who we don't even think know are out there, we being the media, but that on election day they're going to turn out and vote for him in huge numbers and deliver him a victory. And so his campaign is all about galvanizing that specific block of voters rather than trying to win over, you know, higher educated white women who are against him, or African Americans who are against him, or Latinos who are against him, and so on and so forth.
Sarah, just for the sake of argument, we could say, well, there's always been competing narratives in political life in America. That's what politics essentially is a set of competing narratives. If we look back to the George W. Bush administration, there were people who believed and said that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, or perhaps even that Iraq participated in the events of 9/11, which we know not to be the case. There were people who said the opposite of that. I think it was Ron Susskind's book that somebody, who I think we all know as Karl Rove, said, oh, you're still in the reality-based community. We don't really do that anymore. We create reality as we need it. So that, you know, predates the candidacy of Donald Trump. Is there, in fact, anything different going on now, or is it just sort of the noisiness and the raucousness of the rallies, or is there an actual rhetorical shift that's any different from what we've seen in the past?
It's not really a rhetorical shift. I think that, you know, the basic philosophic premise that was expressed by Rove is in effect. I think what's changed is the media environment, particularly social media, and the way that people get their information. You know, we also have had 8 years of, you know, a post-recession economy, which I know isn't felt as deeply out on the coasts, but, you know, I'm in Missouri and, you know, things have not recovered here. People are, you know, panicked. People are very frustrated. And I think when you feel that way, you know, that can lend itself, you know, easily to a conspiratorial mindset. You know, I do want to say that this idea that Trump's base, though, is, you know, comprised primarily of working class people has been debunked many times. You know, it's a real variety of people from different income brackets and different regions. What they have in common is that they're almost overwhelmingly white. And at this point, especially after the Access Hollywood tape, mostly male. And so, you know, what we're seeing here, what differentiates this, I guess, from Rove's era is, you know, an explicit white supremacist ideology and movement that's backed up by a variety of, you know, different groups and parties, many of them armed, that seek, you know, chaos if they can't have victory. And above all, you know, Trump wants power, and that power isn't necessarily the power of being the president. I actually think he'd get bored. You know, forming chaos, causing chaos for this country and bringing it down with him is also a form of power that I think he finds appealing. And, you know, unfortunately, I think we're going to see him trying to enact that power over the next few weeks.
To your earlier point, Nate Silver chillingly tweeted last week that if only men voted in the election, Donald Trump would win. And if only women voted in the election, Hillary Clinton would easily win. Phil Rucker, you know, nobody really knows what Donald Trump's end game is. It doesn't look as though his end game is winning the presidency. It doesn't look like he can do that, although there's still 20-something days to go. Things really can change, but probably not. And there have been these rumors for such a long time, and there's a little tiny bit of confirmation today in the Financial Times that what he's going to do is build his own media network after this, and that if what he wants to do, as Sarah is suggesting, is rile people up, he can also monetize that. You've looked at his rhetoric. You say he's not really pursuing what would normally be the winning strategy of trying to bring in new sectors of the electorate. Does it seem possible to you that what he's going to do is start the new Trump brand in a different way, in a media form?
Sure, it's possible. At this point, it would all be speculative on our part. There's no kind of real hard reporting that he's laying the groundwork for this. But certainly the movement he's created through the course of this campaign can continue and likely will continue after the election if he loses. And he has the power of sort of personality to influence it for, you know, many years to come potentially. And one thing worth keeping in mind is that two of the most influential people in his campaign right now, his chief executive Stephen Bannon and his son-in-law Jared Kushner, are media executives. They have run media companies. This is what they do for a living. They think about how to make profit off of the news and commentary and media. And so certainly they might be thinking about this, but I don't. There's no reporting at this point to suggest that Trump is actually going to do it.
Right. Well, listen, this has been a fascinating discussion. I want to, first of all, thank both of our guests here and, of course, Betsy Kaplan for producing it. We've been talking to Philip Rucker, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, Sarah Kenzie, a writer, researcher, critic. You can read her work on her website and places like The Globe and Mail besides. We're going to take a little break here. We actually have to do a little bit of fundraising. We're in that pledge time. And if you do pledge while we're on the air, I mean, if you like the Colin McEnroe Show and you're going to pledge anyway, pledge while we're on the air, because it does go into the book of the recording angels in our favor. It's always kind of a good thing. And I should tell you also, for some reason or other, people actually look forward to this. I'm not quite sure I understand why. But tomorrow morning, I believe Mr. Dan Kosky and I will be doing the pledge drive. And I mean, we've already gotten at least one tweet, and that's a very scientific measure, by the way, one tweet from somebody saying that he won't give until John and I do the morning fundraiser. So anyway, that's what we'll be doing in the morning. Tomorrow, you can wait till then, or you can really say, hey, I love this show. I'm going to support it. There's some very nice people, extremely nice people, who are coming on right now to talk to you.
These are dark and difficult times. I encourage all Americans to do the responsible thing. Curl up for 20 days with a bunch of Meg Ryan movies and snacks, and then on November 9th, meet the new president on the Empire State Building, just like Sleepless in Seattle. I love that movie. Pull it together, Kyone. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill appeared in the intro, and our interns today were Rusty, Dusty, Shiny, and Squeaky Fisher. Catch up with us on Facebook on the Colin McEnroe Show page. On tomorrow's show, Fools and Jesters. And now, back to Colin.
Yeah, we started out with Rusty Fisher. Now we got all these interns. I don't see really how everybody could meet the new president on the observation deck of the Empire State Building. I agree. It's a very touching moment in the movie, though. All right. So one of the things that I've been wondering a lot about is how the media can even cover, how journalism can cover something that's essentially a dismissal of journalism, a lumping of journalism into an international cabal that apparently includes international banks and Hillary Clinton and God knows who else. Joining me to help figure that out is David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR News, and the author of Murdoch's World, The Last of the Old Media Empires. Get ready. Pre-order the sequel, The Breitbart Years, which we're in right now, I think. David, before we begin talking about what I just said, I want to sort of go back to something else that you've written and talked about, too, which is, I mean, the irony that Donald Trump would be making such a large portion of his current campaign rhetoric an assault on the media when, by most lights, he's a creation of the media.
Yeah, and I put it slightly differently, but I think it's a fair point. I think that he is a self-creation, but that he would have withered without the cultivating glow of the Klieg lights of television cameras on NBC's Apprentice, on the Today Show, taken seriously as a pundit on cable channels like Fox, CNBC, and others, where people turned to this real estate magnate, not really focusing on how uneven his record was. Certainly a wealthy man, a successful man in some ways, and yet a very uneven record, a bunch of bankruptcies, a ton of lawsuits, a lot of controversy, and a lot of, shall we say, inflation of self along the way. I just don't think that this Trump moment could have possibly occurred had he been not treated as seriously as he was by the media for many, many years. And I think the networks at NBC, more recently CNN, but particularly Fox News as well, in the last, call it, 5-10 years, have given him a great, great ride to the point where he could do this. So for him to attack the media is to, you know, attack the one who brought you to the dance, in a sense. And I think that it's a sign of how he rules by visceral gut instinct. It's a sign of also, you know, how much of a showman he is. It's not clear at any one moment how much he truly believes what he says, but he does it with such intensity that a lot of people who look to him for leadership and believe in him take him at his word.
You know, you said Fox News, but actually the two outlets you first mentioned were NBC outlets. And I'd like to take a moment at least to whine a little bit about the vertically integrated role NBC has played in this. As you suggested, he was essentially enshrined in the public consciousness through an entertainment program, The Apprentice. But then, yeah, you know, the Today Show Morning Joe on MSNBC played a big role in kind of letting him onto the airwaves and taking his calls whenever he felt like calling up. And it's gone on. It feeds into other parts of the entertainment cycle. You've got Jimmy Fallon mussing his hair on The Tonight Show. You've got Saturday Night Live, which he's currently not in love with, but they let him host back in November. And now they satirize him, and Chuck Todd plays clips from Saturday Night Live on Meet the Press. And you get the feeling somehow that, you know, there may be people, including Chuck Todd, who are appalled by Donald Trump, but he has been good for business, capital G, capital F, capital B, you know, in this way that spreads across what NBC really is, which is not necessarily just a news brand. Oh, and I didn't even mention Matt Lauer and the Commander-in-Chief Forum, Lester Holt moderating the first debate, that they're both a news brand and an entertainment brand and some stuff that's kind of in a fuzzy area there. And I don't know.
Let me offer you something that I think encapsulates it. Think back to what we learned a couple weeks ago, the videotape of Donald Trump talking about essentially sexually assaulting a woman by grabbing her by her private parts and talking about how he can get away with it because he's rich and wealthy and famous. What was that episode? That episode was he was boasting to Billy Bush. So he was there on a bus to get off a bus at a studio in Los Angeles. What was going on? It was being tracked by Access Hollywood, an NBC property, a soft-focused celebrity news show about Trump's appearance on a soap opera, which itself was owned by NBC. Why was Trump, a real estate guy, appearing on a soap opera? It was to promote a third NBC property, The Apprentice, for which Trump is not only, you know, a major producer, but also the celebrity host. So you have, you know, a neatly closed circuit. You know, this ecosystem is 100% NBC. It's why NBC owned this scandal. In a way one would not want to have possession of it from start to finish, because it was completely an NBC closed circle.
And I guess,
I think speaks to what you're talking about, to the degree of vertical integration on that.
And I guess I wonder, you know, people who do the job that you do, or whether it's on the media team from WNYC, or, you know, press critics like Margaret Sullivan and Jack Schaefer, you guys are there kind of with the ref's whistles, seeing if you can maybe get their attention and get them to see they're not behaving like real entities of journalism. I mean, in a way, you really do feel like NBC should be called on the carpet when this whole thing is all over to say, look, you guys are really, in a very circular way, a big part of the problem here, a big part of the distortion of our political perceptions. But I would imagine that getting their attention about something like that, or certainly getting them to toe the line or take a 5-yard penalty, is going to be pretty hard.
I think a lot of things happen with the distance of time, and a lot of things happen when there are no microphones present. There are a lot of people within NBC News right now who are deeply ashamed of the way in which Trump was promoted and the way in which the network handled the Billy Bush video, which is to say being beaten by the Washington Post on something that was not only in their possession, but they knew they had for a number of days and should have known they had for quite a bit longer. So, you know, I think that that was – it's not to say that's the only instance in which NBC has some culpability in some ways of promoting Trump. It's just to say that's an incredibly profound encapsulation of it. And people at NBC, I can tell you, internally feel very strongly about that. A lot of the journalists, people, not just the opinion folks who might be more liberal in the, you know, at MSNBC, but they're journalists, they're reporters, they're anchors. You know, these are people who wince at this stuff. They don't. You know, they know that they have made a compromise and an accommodation, and a lot of the commercial networks have done this. The thing that's a little ironic is that Andy Lack, who's the chairman of NBC News, is looking at all this, and he kind of inherited it. Who was the head of NBC Entertainment when the Apprentice was really whisking along in the ratings and was being promoted so heavily? It was a guy named Jeff Zucker. Mm-hmm. Who is Jeff Zucker now? He's the chairman of CNN. You know, so he's looking at the guy at the cable news across the way here in Manhattan and saying, thanks so much for bequeathing this legacy to me. Now I've got to clean up after you.
Well, the Zucker has been very honest about the fact that Trump was good for the bottom line over at CNN. He issued a kind of mini mea culpa over the last few days, saying, oh, maybe we put too many of his rallies on the air. But, I mean, it's the same thing.
Would Zucker have been saying that if Trump were still giving them an interview every day? You know, CNN and MSNBC and Fox, to some degree, you know, really during the primary season, just were being propelled along in the ratings by having those rallies essentially unedited on the air live in a way that none of the other candidates, certainly in the Republican side, almost ever got. And they also had him on the air repeatedly to talk. And why was that? Is because you never knew what he was going to say next. What fresh outrage or surprise? What was he going to do? Or was he going to hold back this time? You didn't know. It's the uncertainty principle. It's what made, you know, NFL football, until very recently, such a guaranteed ratings lock, was you didn't know the outcome of the big game. Well, you know, Zucker is now willing to be more critical in a way that months ago he was not, in part because it's pretty clear Trump has retreated to much safer confines of Fox News, and even in Fox News to hosts like Bill O'Reilly, and particularly Sean Hannity or Fox and Friends, who are going to give him very kid glove treatment.
So not only do we have Donald Trump running this campaign that relies heavily on the trope of the media is helping to rig the election, on the other side, the media is getting criticized by all kinds of people, including President Obama on Thursday, who talked about America's wild, wild west media. This is a guy who's a constitutional scholar and a lecturer on the Constitution at the university level before all this started. He said, we're going to have to rebuild within this wild, wild west of information flow some sort of curating function that all people agree to. There has to be, I think, some sort of way in which we can sort through the information that passes some basic truthiness tests and those we have to discard because they don't have any basis in anything that's actually happening in the world. Well, I mean, presidents often get mad at the media. Nixon hated the press about as much as Trump claims to. But it's a little weird, isn't it? I mean, it's not that he's like suggesting some government action against the press, but he is the president saying, at the moment, the free flow of information doesn't seem to work right.
Yeah, it's not really clear how he could possibly achieve that sort of nebulous goal, or whether it would be a particularly good function for government to take into effect. The media has to function as the media. I mean, part of the problem, Brendan Nyhan is a political scientist up at the University of New Hampshire, up at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, and a few others have really looked at the question of when the media corrects things, does the public absorb the correction or does the public absorb the original wrong information? And the results are not altogether heartening, I've got to say. That said, the media has to find ways to reach people, to convince people that you know, they're doing their best effort to find the information, give it in a fair context, present their homework so that people know how they arrived at that, the findings that they make. You know, the Washington Post has been very tough on Donald Trump when you look at the story of his contributions to charitable causes. But my goodness, David Farenthold has done all of his reporting, both in the paper on its website and on Twitter, essentially in front of our eyes, in a way that it's very clear exactly what organizations he's been reaching out to, the scope of his reporting, the depths to which he's gone to try to find out information from people close to Trump and just to get rebuttal information to say, well, maybe this information is good. Maybe he really did give this money. And he has shown there's been almost utter absence of any charitable donations of the kinds that Trump has publicly boasted about. So that's the kind of reporting that you can do that you just can't simply dismiss it away. There's other reporting where it just gets caught up in the hue and cry. Well, you know, Hillary Clinton this and Donald Trump that. So it's all equal. It's all part of the political season. I think what we're witnessing in front of us is, you know, the press trying to come to terms with a candidate and phenomenon that we certainly haven't had the likes of in generations. I think you saw the press, to my mind, in the primary season go very easy on Trump because he wasn't a political figure that they had a conventional political record to explore. And then I think you've seen some big guns being brought out, particularly by the Times and the Washington Post, the latter of which I think has done leading work, to really go to town on his business records, his connection with power, his claims, the ways in which he's abused his position, and most recently, how he's used his power, I think, toward women in very repugnant ways, at least according to numerous and seemingly substantiated accusations.
Although there is almost an epistemological problem that's left over, and maybe it's unsolvable, that if, in fact, you know, the fundamental message of Donald Trump right now is everything the press says about me that's negative is a lie, it's difficult for the press to cover that. You know, I mean, the people who believe it are not probably persuadable.
Right. And then there's the real question. I think if you allow those allegations to occur, as the press has done when he's made sort of wild accusations against other institutions without any substantiation, any evidence supporting his claims, if the press simply reports his allegations about the media and about specific stories without then offering some context that counterbalance that, that say actually there's a lot of substantiation to this, or actually numerous outlets have shown, you know, on the record interviews and documentation as to why this is the case, then it's, you know, a lens in a certain sense weight to his accusations without any kind of rebuttal. And I think if you rebut it only, you know, a couple days later in a fact check, that's a tepid forum in which to do that only. I think our fact checking has to be incorporated into our reporting. And even then, we have to acknowledge there are ways in which we simply won't reach every voter. But I think that we've got to allow people to make up their own minds, but we've got to equip them not just to be consumers of this news, but citizens. And that's not to put your thumb on the scale, but it's also not to fail to acknowledge what the scale is reading in front of you when you've done your work.
David Folkenflik, great to talk to you. I think the solution may be some kind of We Are the World type video featuring Oprah and Glenn Beck and Mike Pence.
And I'll gladly pledge money to WNPR if we can avoid that.
Come on now. It's the one thing that might change minds. We've got to get everybody together in a recording studio. All right, David Folkenflik, media correspondent for NPR News. Thanks for being with us. Well, we have a few minutes here, a scant few minutes at the end of the show for you to express your profound support and appreciation. And we do get a little check mark next to our names in the angelic ledger if you do it now. So do it now. I think we had Katie and Lucy in there. If they can't talk you into it, I don't know who could.
Well, that is the end of our show. Wait a minute. The media lies. I'm a member of the media, so it is not the end of our show today.